I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Our guest today is artist Charles Kraft. Charlie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be talking to you again, Greg.
Well, it's good to be talking to you. You have had a really eventful 2013. Back at the beginning of the year, you were outed by a local alternative paper, The Stranger in Seattle, as not just a revered porcelain artist who's been exhibited all over the world, but also as a Holocaust denier and as a racist and a white nationalist. And that led to a firestorm in the media. And what I'd like to do today is I'd like to talk about that, just recap it a little bit, and talk about what's happened since then. Because a lot of our listeners probably worry that someday they might be outed as a white nationalist, for instance, and they worry about the consequences for them. And you have provided a really good example of somebody who was singled out in the media for attack. You stood up for yourself. And I'd like to find out how it's all played out in nearly the 1 year that's passed since then.
Where do you want to begin?
Well, let's begin with the attack. What happened? Just recap it a bit.
The story, in a nutshell, is that I had a kind of a stalker on my Facebook page that was using pretty crude language, who people thought was a sock puppet of mine. And one of the persons that thought I had a sock puppet with a foul mouth was a psychology teacher at a local college who messaged me on Facebook. And her message was that she was surprised I hadn't been outed as a bigot by the local art community. And she mentioned this poster on my Facebook page, and I told her that it was not me, and that furthermore, I was not going to censor the poster because I didn't like censorship, even if the poster was kind of using crude language. And I said I really don't like censorship at all. And I also suggested that if she felt I should be outed, that maybe she should be the one to do the outing. So apparently she did write a letter to the local art critic and out me to the critic, who wrote to me and asked me about the Holocaust, what I thought about the Holocaust. And I wrote that critic back and said, well, gee, you know, I'm in a position here that's between a rock and a hard place. I've written one essay about the Holocaust, which I can send to you if you'd like to look it over, and which I did. And I told the critic that I didn't want to be interviewed at that particular time about this. She was angling for some kind of a story, obviously. So she wrote me back and she said, fair enough. If we won't pursue it. About 8 months later, I got an email from her and she said, I'm, whether or not you like it or not, I am going ahead to write about you, and I have some questions I'd like to ask you. You can answer them or you cannot answer them. Whether or not you do answer or not answer is not going to make any difference to me. I'm working on a story and it's coming out soon. I said, okay, fine. Send me the questions you want answered. And so I got a series of questions, which I answered. And then this story came out while I was in India attending the Kumbh Mela, which is a big Hindu religious festival that happens once every 12 years in Allahabad. And I thought from India that this story would be a small kind of gossipy storm in a local teacup in Seattle, where I lived all my life. And I know all the people here that are involved in the arts, not all of them, but quite a number of them. And I thought, well, you know, this will be interesting because I knew about The Stranger and I knew a little bit about the way they worked, and I expected the worst, and I did get it. But that story went viral and it got picked up all over the world. And as a result of it going out and getting seen and picked up, I started getting requests from the mainstream media for interviews and comments. And I said yes to everybody that asked me for an interview, and I must have done about 5 or 6 of them. And finally, I got a letter from an editor of the local Seattle Jewish newsletter here, she wanted me to interview me, and I drew the line. And I finally said, I'm just going to be giving you more rope to hang me, and nothing good has come of most of the interviews I've given, and I'm going silent now. So for a while there, I was an open book and saying yes to everybody, and then I finally just got tired of being interviewed, and so I quit doing it.
So would you advise people who are in a similar situation simply not to give interviews at all?
Well, I would advise them that they can give an interview, but if it's with a mainstream media outlet, there's no way that they're going to be able to put themselves over well. The cards are stacked against you going in, so you might as well, if you say yes to it, like NPR, for instance, the way it's ultimately edited and presented will be probably a negative for you if you're a white nationalist or a skeptic about the received history of the Holocaust.
I remember the Kurt Anderson interview with you, and there was stuff in there that seemed obviously taken out of context. One of the things that I always recommend to people who give audio interviews or video interviews is to let the interviewer know that you're making your own reference copy of the interview, either audio or video. And I think that's one of the ways that we can try and keep these people honest. But if they just have the only copy of the tape, they will cut it up and shuffle it around any way they want. And yeah, their tendency is to put things in the most negative possible light.
Yeah, and they do a lot with that bumper music, too, that they use. That Kurt Anderson interview was 30 minutes of talk back and forth with him, and I think it only ended up as 7 minutes on his program, 7 to 10 minutes. And he made me look like I was insane. I walked right into a trap that he set for me. I re-listened to it recently, and I thought I did okay, but he got, you know, at the end, he had the upper hand.
Yeah, yeah. You'd have to be a fool not have the upper hand if you're the one who's holding all the cards and gets to edit the thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the trouble with the mainstream media. Yeah, they have all the cards. You give them the raw data. They fashion it into a rope to hang you with.
Right.
So we ran 3 articles about this at Countercurrents. Do you have an estimate of how many articles ended up being published about this controversy?
Well, I have a friend who's an artist that was following the controversy, and he claims that there were 70, he counted 71 places where this story and permutations of the story appeared on the internet. In print, the only things that came out were the Stranger article, you know, hard copy. And then I got, believe it or not, the front page of the local Saturday edition of the Sunday paper here. And then when the Sunday edition came out, I was in the lifestyle section instead of on the front page, because the Sunday paper comes out a day early here. And they have 2, you know, 1 for Saturday and 1 for Sunday. But they call this, it's kind of an early edition and an early Sunday edition and a late Sunday edition. And I was on the front page of the early Sunday edition. So just in print, only two places where it appeared. But a lot of blogs and websites picked up Jen Graves' story and just repeated it word for word. So if indeed there were 71 instances where my name and this issue appeared on a blog or on a website, I would say that 2/3 of that were just repetitions of the original Stranger story.
So you also made the Huffington Post's year-end roundup. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, the Huffington Post really made Jen Graves kind of famous because they reprinted her Stranger story, and then 2 of their writers decided to comment on the story that she, you know, had written for the Stranger. So I got actually 3 Huffington Post articles at the time, and then right before Christmas they did a year-end roundup of the 12 biggest art fails of 2013, and I was number 6 on their list of the art fails. So I guess they're being kind of cheeky, I guess. That was the point of listing these art fails.
Snarky.
Yes, yeah. Snarky.
Yeah, so what company were you in amongst these art fails? There were some pretty well-known artists and dealers who were mentioned there. It's kind of not bad publicity, in a sense, when you look at the people that you're in the company of.
I think I was in the one I remember the most was the Bolshoi Ballet.
Exactly.
Apparently, they put on some performance that everybody hated. But anyway, there I am, you know, with the Bolshoi Ballet. I can't remember the other people I was in the company of.
One huge Armenian-American art dealer, I forget his name, that was mentioned in there because one of his exhibits was not PC enough or something like that. And I thought, wow, I mean, you're an august company. Yeah, all of these people have fallen afoul of the politically correct.
Was it Tony Shafrazi?
You know, I don't know. I can't remember the name. But anyway, yeah, I didn't think it really amounted to bad publicity in the end.
Oh, I was absolutely thrilled to be remembered and then stuck in this august company, you know.
Exactly. So tell us what happened to your exhibitions and speaking engagements and things like this after the story started circulating.
Well, the speaking engagements on college campuses, it sort of dropped off. At one particular point a few years ago, I was getting invitations to give slide lectures to graduate students in the art departments of various art schools and universities around the country. And that was a part of my annual income. I get a honorarium and probably a dinner out of the deal with the head of the department. And then I give my lecture and then I visit the graduate students and do these personal one-on-one conversations with them about their work and what they might expect once they get done with school. So I learned from a kid in Ann Arbor, Michigan, who had wanted me to come to his college to talk, that I was on a list of proscribed intellectuals that were to be avoided by college department heads who were looking for speakers and visitors. And I can't remember the acronym of the name of this organization, but there's apparently a group of academics who advise other academics on who's good and who's bad for college speaking engagements. And I'm now on some sort of a blacklist, I guess. He told me that his department head had brought him a sheaf of printouts about me that had been provided by this organization, this academic organization, when they did a search on me. So I can't say that anything was canceled because I hadn't been getting invited I hadn't had any invitations last year to visit colleges, but I did learn about being put on this list. And what was the other half of that question?
What happened to your exhibition?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was in a show in Paris. It was about urban art and lowbrow art. In Europe, they call lowbrow art street art now. And so this is sort of a street art show. And I was asked to do what they call a Proust questionnaire, which you often see in the back of Vanity Fair magazine when they ask a celebrity a bunch of questions about themselves. Are you familiar with Proust questionnaires?
Yeah.
Well, for those that aren't, it's just they ask you who's the most inspirational person in your life and what scares you the most and what color is your favorite color. These kind of little questions that are supposed to help people get a fix on your personality. They sent me this Proust questionnaire, which was going to be published in the catalog along with, my biographical information. Every artist in the exhibition got I never did get my catalog, by the way, the show catalog. They never sent it to me. This is after I was, my work was taken out of the show. Some leftist Antifa blog in Paris picked up the story and published their comments about me, which caused the people that ran the venue where the show was being presented to ask the curators to remove my work. When I got the email from them about this, I was livid, and I wrote a little statement back to them, and I had no more communications about the issue with them until I received my work back in the mail. I never got to read my Proust questionnaire, which I had to revise. They had a problem with the first one I submitted. I never got the catalog sent to me. Well, that was part of the deal. I was going to get a free catalog, contributors catalog. And then I never heard another word again from these two editors of an art magazine in Paris called Hey, H-E-Y exclamation point. And I just assume because they're French that they're, obviously they were upset with me, I guess. And I didn't even want to deal with them anymore. I mean, so I didn't write back. I sent them this statement about cultural Marxism and not wanting to march in Gramscian lockstep with the other artists in the show. It was kind of an angry little thing, a little statement. So yeah, I got censored in France, where they have a Gaysaut law, which is a law about Holocaust denial that they mentioned. The curator said it's illegal for us to. I guess what they were telling me is guilt by association. If we have a Holocaust denier in our show, we are somehow liable too for this. So they brought up this Gaysaut law as part of the reason why they censored me.
I think you also mentioned that various museums where your work is displayed have started putting up warning labels, sort of like parental guidance things or something.
At the Sacramento Museum, somebody that I know took a picture with their cell phone of the new identification tag alongside a piece of mine that was donated to their collection. And there's a qualifier about me being recently outed as a Holocaust denier. I mean, I don't know why they had to put that on this identification card, because what they're displaying has nothing to do with the Holocaust. But there I am, it's Charles Kraft, and they say, he was recently on, they mentioned this NPR business, that I was on NPR. So that's the only instance I know where they're starting to put warning labels on my art.
Well, maybe you should just incorporate warning labels as a kind of design motif in your future work. I mean, why not get out ahead of this and own it?
Well, now that I could do just about anything I want in the way of épater la bourgeoisie, I mean, the cat's out of the bag. I mean, what have I got to lose?
Right, right. So tell us a little bit about the positive and the negative consequences of all of this for you. Tell us first a bit about some of the personal fallout. I understand that there was some relationship drama, family drama, things like that.
Yeah, there's some family drama, which I won't go into really too seriously. Relationship drama, I probably steer clear of that too. I did get some letters from people, from old friends, and they were lecturing me on my morality and calling into question, my sense of good and my sense of decency. They think that not believing the received history of the Holocaust is indecent. And so they let me know how indecent they felt that was. And one of them had CC'd his whole family. He's got grown children. So each of the children got this letter, this email that he sent to me, expressing his disappointment, and my moral failings. I didn't get a Christmas card from those people this year, I noticed. So there's that. And then an old teacher that I'd been corresponding with over the last 40 years, whom I had as my freshman English teacher in college, wrote me a letter and said we could no longer be friends as a result of, you know, what he'd read about me in the newspapers. It was kind of like I don't know how to describe this letter other than it was a rather final write-off of this friendship, that this correspondence and ongoing friendship that we'd had since 1966 when I first met him.
That's amazing. Did you make any new friends?
Yeah, well, I made a lot of new friends. Not a lot, because there's not a lot of us, but within the, let's call it the white nationalist movement, people actually sat down at their computers, most of them, and sent, you know, found out where they could contact me and sent me letters of support, emails that said, I think what, you know, I'm glad that you're standing up for yourself and not letting these people get you down. I appreciated that. I got a couple of letters, believe it or not, from readers of the local newspaper who put stamps on envelopes and sent me letters of support. I don't know who these guys are, but they took the time to let me know that they felt I'd been kind of smeared, and they didn't like it, and they believed that I should be allowed to say whatever I felt about just anything. I mean, there's a free, we have a First Amendment in the United States. So these letters of and emails of support sort of drifted in, and I appreciated the time that people actually took to sit down and address me personally. I mean, that in this day and age, when somebody does that, it's meaningful.
Oh, definitely. Very few people write letters anymore, so
yeah.
They do that. It's a sign of something, definitely.
Yeah, it really is. It's a sign of like a commitment to, you know, to an old-fashioned way of expressing, you know, your opinion and your support of a person. So there was that, and then I got a big spike in Facebook friend requests from people that are sort of in our camp. And so I approved all of those, and I engaged with some conversations with other artists that are, some of whom are sort of out of the closet on their politics, and then others who sent me messages that they regretted that they couldn't come out of the closet about how they really felt about things because of their professional careers and their academic careers. A lot of college kids, they seem to be really worried if somebody finds out what they really think about things as they're going through school, getting brainwashed, you know, by these teachers of theirs. So that was an upshot of this. It was about 50. I think that the positive was actually outweighed the negative, to tell you the truth. I mean, there was a lot of negative ink spilled about me, but on a personal level, I got more positive responses than I did negative ones.
Well, that's great. Was this personally difficult for you? I mean, I imagine you kind of dreaded looking at your emails for a while.
Yeah, I did. I dreaded it. What I did was there's a Google search option that you can use for Google to harvest anything that comes through them about a subject or a person that you want to know more about or a news item. And I put my name in the Google search box for any articles about Charles Kraft. And every day there was a new one. I go, oh my God, you know, and I go there and I look, and it was always the same kind of, you know, smear. So, yeah, I did dread the Google search notifications that there had been another article somewhere about me, because I have to go and read it. And these people, what happens is that it's like a circle jerk. And you find this when you're reading books too, especially history books. People will use what other people have said or repeat, you know, a falsehood. that's almost impossible to correct. I could have gone to the comments sections and the places where these articles appeared and corrected them on certain things, but I just finally felt it was a waste of time. There was so much that was so wrong. I couldn't spend the rest of my day, just trying to put out fires. So I just let it all slide, except for the Vice interview. There was a Vice London guy called me up on the telephone transatlantically and wanted an interview, which I gave to him. And then once he got it in the pipeline and posted on Vice, I really didn't like it. And he put words into my mouth and he'd used English colloquialisms that I don't use and made me look like an awful person. So I did actually go in and make a comment at that particular site about this guy's, the way he had managed to mangle his story. But that was it. I steered clear of trying to defend myself in these places. It's just a waste of time.
Right, right. The number of people who can generate nonsense about you is it's pretty much infinite compared to your ability to answer all of this nonsense.
Yeah, you just can't answer it all. And like I said, to get back to this thing about one person will say one thing and then the next hack journalist or hack blogger will pick up that thing and repeat it. So it gets repeated over and over and over again, and sometimes they'll add their two cents to this repetition until it ends up just looking, it's nothing like what it was. It's like that thing where you play a game and you whisper something into somebody's ear and they're supposed to whisper it to the next person who whispers it to the next person. And finally, at the end of the game, what started out as the secret turns out to be something completely else.
There's a story about the UN where the English phrase, "the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak," was translated by the translation team into all these different languages. And when it got translated back into English, it was, "the wine is good, but the meat is rotten."
Yeah.
So what are some of the professional consequences of this? Has this hurt you economically?
Well, no, it hasn't hurt me economically. However, I was working on a commission when the story broke for a local guy who then refused to pay me for what I'd made for him. He had requested three objects, and which I had gone ahead and done for him. I wouldn't have done them otherwise in the manner in which he wanted them. So I called that a commission. He was very, he said somebody has just told me about some press that you've gotten recently, and I'd like to ask you some questions. And I said, well, fine, but let's keep this not about business. We have a business relationship here. I don't want to get into philosophy and religion and politics. Let's stay away from it. And I never heard back from him, and he never came to pay me for what he made or for what I made for him. It was really a cold kind of dismissal.
Did you deliver the stuff to him, or did you?
No. I said, your stuff is ready. And okay. I sent him photographs of it. And then I never heard again from him. And this is after he said he wanted to ask me some questions, and I said, yes, I'll answer them, but I don't want to. Our relationship is not about religion or politics. Ours is about business. And then I never heard back again from him, and he never paid me for what I did.
Did you manage to sell it to somebody else?
Yes, I did. I turned around immediately, and I sold it, the three pieces that I made for him, to a collector in France.
Well, great, great. So that's a wash.
Yeah. But the way the guy did it was impolite and unprofessional. And I disliked it so much, I thought I'd write him a note about how I felt. And then I thought, well, no, I don't want to let him know that, I even think this about him. So I didn't want to waste any more time with this fool. So I didn't send him a letter. He should have said, well, I can't go along with your politics, or I can't, you know, I can't have this stuff in my home now that you're been blackballed by the community, you know. He just quit communicating. So
overall, though, can you say that in 2013, your business, your purely business aspect of your artwork, was up or down or pretty much the same?
It's pretty much the same, with a little bit of a spike.
That's great. Did you get new commissions from people who were sympathetic?
Yes, I did. I got commissions from people that felt that it would be a way to support me, and they were sympathetic, and they enjoyed my art, and then they said, now is the time I'd like to buy some. So they made a kind of a commitment as a result of the press I got.
That's great. That's really great.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. A couple, I mean, I'm talking about, we're talking here about 4 or 5 people that did this. You know, they actually just stepped up to the plate and bought some art from me as a result of the interview that I did with you, you know, earlier, the 2 interviews around that time.
Right.
They'd heard him.
That's great. That's great. The enemy tries to destroy people by destroying their livelihoods. And it's important to know that when you're an independent businessman, you are somewhat immune to that. And you might lose some customers, but other people, if they hear about this and get incensed by the injustice, are going to step up and try and make sure that they can't hurt you. And that kind of solidarity within our sphere is a really positive sign, I think.
I do too. And I can't thank these people enough for helping me out.
So, Charlie, tell me about the artists. Obviously, you don't want to name names, but tell me about some of the artists that you have been contacted by. And has this spawned any new artistic collaborations or projects?
Well, you know, I think it might be best for me not to mention names of artists, but I got contacted by White Rabbit Radio.
Right.
And as a result of that, I'm sort of working with the artist that does the graphics for Horus the Avenger. He's sort of the in-house artist there. And he lives in Kentucky. And he and I are working on a project now together. And Horus himself, he bought a piece from me. He's one of these people that heard the interview, actually wanted to purchase something for his collection, did so, and now I'm talking to him about another piece that I'm making especially for him. So those guys are fully committed members of this white nationalist community, and they're very supportive. So I appreciate it. And I'm glad I'm in touch with them, because it's just nice to have other people that are art makers and culture makers to talk to, you know, about business, because we're tradesmen. And so I'm always looking for other people that are in the same kind of trade I'm in, and just to talk about it. I like what I do, and if they like what they do, it's fun to compare notes and ideas.
One of the things that I really want to try and encourage in whatever small way I can with Countercurrents is the kind of artistic subculture that existed on the right in the first half of the 20th century. There was a lot of excitement. There were a lot of great artists and poets who were involved with this. And there are all these amazing manifestos from the futurists and the vorticists, people like Marinetti and Wyndham Lewis. I would like to see more of that in the future, in the 21st century. Do you think anything like that sort of artistic subculture or movement might be helped along by some of this exposure that you've got and some of the networking that has taken place since then?
Yes. I think eventually something will be done, because I remember zines in coming out. This is sort of even before the age of the computer. Were you around? Did you ever subscribe to any of these zines? You know that people were self-publishing magazines.
Well, I was sort of a late to all this, so that was more like mid-90s.
Yeah,
and it kind of died with the internet. But I remember reading copies after it stopped publishing. But I remember reading Answer Me, Jim Goad zine, and that was pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah. That was, well, that's exactly what I'm leading up to. Goad's magazine, Answer Me, it came out of the zine culture. It was pretty nicely published, and it ended up on magazine racks and places like Tower Records. Well, I recall even back then, music zines having discussions about, occult, fascism and occultism and music and fascism and occultism and music and this mix, you see, of music, occultism and fascism and national socialism. And that's where I started learning about these artists from Europe who had been completely swept underneath the carpet after 1945. I mean, I'd never heard of any of these people. I mean, Ernst Jünger, for example. How would I have ever found out about Ernst Jünger if I had been reading music, neo-folk zines, you know?
Right.
So there's a list of names of people that we could go over that I discovered through this little self-publishing world, which was transposed into internet blogging, where, you can go and find out about it. And I think, yeah, it would be nice if something like Answer Me, with that much of an audience, a national audience, a kind of like a mainstream newsstand audience or a mainstream bookstore audience, I think that we might build up a critical mass eventually, so we could have a magazine like that. That's the way Juxtapose started. It was a reaction against these academic art magazines that everybody was just bored to tears with. Art in America and some of these other highbrow art magazines initiated Juxtapose, and then Juxtapose led to High Fructose magazine, and it opened up a whole new window into another area of art making that the mainstream art magazines were completely clueless about. Yeah, it would be, I think if there's enough people with enough, well, that have the time to sit down and put together, to curate their interests and to write about that, about their interests, we might be able to get something going, an anthology. And it would be probably kind of a pioneering thing too, because I tend to think that the more and more people that read books and think about things more seriously than most are starting to see through the what we're being presented is by the mainstream media in the way of dialogue and these news stories and discussions about culture and politics. A lot of people can just see right through it. A lot of people quit watching television. I know New York Times. People are no longer grabbing the Sunday Times to spend the Sunday in bed with it because they know that there's a lot of BS going on there.
Yeah, I think the system is sort of losing its grip on people's minds. I don't think a lot of people are willing to affirm an alternative yet, but they do know deep down inside that what they're getting is a thinner and thinner PC gruel, and it's not healthy for them.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the cultural mavens are being exposed as having feet of clay. I mean, Noam Chomsky, for example, people are beginning to think, well, yeah, he's a gatekeeper. I mean, smart people are starting to figure out who's been precision placed to keep us sort of in a mental box about issues. So I see people waking up all over the net, but Then again, you know, I spend my time on the internet in all these oddball places. I'm way off in the fringe looking for more and more eccentric art and commentary. So I'm not a good example of a person that is balanced anymore, because I've swung way, way, way over to the fringe. I don't even center leftist, center rightist. I'm not interested anymore. I'm interested in extremism. And I'm not ashamed to say it. I mean, that's where I find the most excitement in writing and in art making.
Well, that's where culture is created. It's on the extremes. No culture is created in the center, you know, unless it's junk culture, Lawrence Welk kitsch and things like that. Your Facebook feed, I might add, is a great source for me. And my conversations with you over the years, I've always, you can attest to this, I carry around a notebook and I'm always jotting down names of artists and museums and books and things like that, because you are just indefatigable in turning up interesting new stuff. And every time I talk to you, the world gets bigger. So I really appreciate that. And your Facebook feed gives that to me on a daily basis.
Oh, well, thanks. Because, you know, on my Facebook feed, I'm essentially just sharing my own discoveries. It's not like I know all this already. It's like I spend time sort of exploring, and then when I find something interesting, I hurry up and want to share it. That's the way I've been all my life. When something excites me, my immediate reaction is to tap somebody on the shoulder next to me and say, "Hey, get a load of this. Isn't this interesting?" So I've always been kind of eager to share what I found out about this and that. That's why it's hard for me to keep a secret, you know, hard for me to be fly below the radar.
Well, you know, it's really amusing when they finally outed you in 2013. You know, I did a search for you on the internet to sort of background to do the interview with you and the articles I wrote. And I remember in 2005 and 2008, I think those were the years, you were given an award for writing an essay on some Holocaust hoax. You did an interview on this stuff. This stuff was floating around out there a long, long time ago. You weren't trying to keep the secret, really. But it took Jen Graves 8 years or so to finally catch up with this and start jumping up and down and pointing at the witch. So I thought, you know, it's not a well-kept secret.
No, it wasn't.
You were hidden out there in plain view.
Last night I was reading, you know, something about Mircea Eliade. Somebody was writing a book about Portugal during the war, and I knew that Eliade had been to Portugal. So I did this search on Eliade in Portugal, and I landed on this blog. It's called Politics and Metaphysics. And there was an article there on Eliade, and I read this thing. And then I went down to the comments section, and I'm reading the comments, and I'm totally intrigued by the whole thing. And then I come to one of my own comments that I'd left there in 2009. I don't even remember reading the article or leaving a comment. and you know, it was a pretty good article. A comment. I was really surprised myself. I said, "Jesus, you've been here before. You forgot all about it."
That's happened to me. I've used so many pen names over the years. I remember doing a Google search on something, and I clicked it and started reading and thought, this is really good.
Yeah, this is
really good. And then suddenly realized, oh, I wrote this.
I wrote this. Yeah, that's happened to me.
Well, Charlie, I want to just make a promise here or an offer. I mean, I got a full plate at Countercurrents, but I would be willing to publish something that would be like an annual or a zine or whatever. If it would be, you know, a forum for people who are artists today who want to make statements and do analyses and issue manifestos, and also a historical study of great artists of the past, if that would in any way contribute to the fertilization of a New Right artistic subculture. I think that would be a tremendous contribution. It's one of the things I want to do. I don't know what form it would take. I would probably like it to be sort of a larger coffee table size thing, or like a magazine size thing. One of these things like high fructose volumes and other volumes like that. I have a lot of those. So anyway, if there are people listening who are into this sort of thing, and if you're interested in something like this, if you want to edit or curate a project like this, Countercurrents will make it happen.
These seminal books that I remember that actually had an impact on me from the 90s were little anthologies, and one of them was Apocalypse Culture. Do you ever remember seeing that?
Oh yeah, those had a huge influence on me.
That was just he did a follow up about a decade later, Apocalypse Culture 2. But just that little collection of weirdness that Adam Parfrey put between covers, it really had an impact on a lot of people. As did those research anthologies that were coming out of San Francisco on strange music and strange film and neo-primitivism and tattooing and piercing, that kind of thing.
Right.
And interviews with oddballs that they conducted there, these fringe characters that they'd unearth and get to talk for the first time to another generation of people. Esquivel, I don't know if you ever heard of him, but or Cola Pundit, you know, an old organ player from the who go around the country in the 1950s and play the organ in a turban, and they go find these crazy guys that have been celebrities in their day, but time had passed them over, and then put them between covers. They became cool again all of a sudden. Martin Denny, the exotic,
right.
Stuff. Well, if we could somehow package a collection of interviews, essays, and photographs and art pieces that would relate to what we're interested in, I think we might be able to make some sort of a dent, you know, I don't know, maybe the whatever's on the shelf next to the kids in the college dormitories, that's where I'd like to see it end up.
Exactly. Get something out there that it's just mind expanding and fertilizing to the imagination. And I really do have to give Adam Parfrey a lot of credit for the Apocalypse Culture volumes, because they really did have that effect. And some of the stuff he published was so funny that I threw my back out laughing at it.
Yeah. Well, he's still, provoking people with his publications. And David Cole is coming out with a book in the spring. It's called Republican Party Animal.
Okay.
And I don't know if you know about it.
Oh, I know about David Cole. Yeah, that sounds like a really is this a Feral House publication?
Yeah, and David Cole's going to talk about himself and his career. So I'm looking forward to hearing all about that.
Yeah, I guess the title Republican Party Reptile was already taken by P.J. O'Rourke. So.
Oh, really? I'm really interested to find out who in Hollywood is a Republican, by the way.
That would be a really interesting question, although the Republicans are so useless anyway. It almost doesn't matter.
Yeah, just anybody there that's a reactionary to the usual Hollywood leftist agenda.
So let's sum up, Charlie. This has been a really enjoyable conversation. If somebody is out there in radio land who's thinking of taking the plunge and becoming a little more open about their political views and being explicit white nationalist, what advice would you give them?
Run that by me again.
Based on your experience over the last nearly 1 year,
yeah.
If somebody is out there who's thinking of becoming more open about their political activism under their own name, or if somebody out there, you know, who doesn't want the publicity is about to get the bomb dropped on them by some other alternative weekly, can you give those people a little bit of advice about how to handle it, how you've handled it? And is it so bad?
You're going to have to ask yourself, how much time do you want to waste talking to idiots? Because you're going to get approached by people that are not only not only upset with your views, they think that they're immoral and out of line, but they're not, probably not as well read as you, and so, or aware of how you got arrived at your opinions. So when they come, they're not, you got to remember that they're not as well versed in the subject as you are, and you have to ask yourself, how much time do you want to spend trying to educate these people who are there to do you harm anyway? So that's one thing I'd like to get across. The second thing is, it's going to blow over if it's a big storm. It only lasts a while because they have to get on to other news, and you're going to be yesterday's fish wrap soon enough. Friends and family, you're going to have to be probably pretty strong in your commitment to your beliefs, because you don't want to hurt people's feelings that are close to you, and they do get hurt by the peer pressure that they get in this guilt by association trip that gets laid on to anybody that is close to you, that is open to attack. The social sphere is the worst. Professional, I mean, if you're self-employed, I wouldn't, you know, waste any too much time worrying about losing your job, really. If you work in a corporate office kind of context, you know, there's human resources. Those people are deadly. You're going to have to worry about that, probably. It might even be a good idea to just keep it under your hat, what you think, if you're in the corporate sphere. I don't know what else to say other than you can't turn back once you amassed a certain amount of information about something, and you know that what you've learned is probably the truth. I mean, how can you just go back after you've come, you know, into more truth than you had before? You're just going to have to live with it, and if it gets really tough, you can read about these other people that had a harder time than you did. I mean, for God's sakes, back in the 50s and the 40s, some of the people that were talking about the stuff that we're talking about were hounded out of their jobs. Some of them were brought, you know, to trial. And we're not talking about the blacklisting either. We're talking about the people on the other side of the fence. Anti-Semitic preachers and anti-integrationists in the South, intellectuals. I mean, people that were actually college-educated, non-civil rights participants and activists who spoke up were pilloried, and they probably had a lot tougher time than I ever had. So when you do get in this position, which it's scary at first, just remember that you're not the only one that it's happened to, and that you're probably, your trials and travails are, you're not going to be hung, for God's sakes. I mean, we have a little bit more leeway in America with our First Amendment rights than they do in Europe, so it's not going to be as bad. The social thing is the worst. I mean, when you have friends that disavow themselves from you, or the gossip starts up and some of it gets back to you, it that could be kind of hurtful. So be prepared for getting your feelings hurt.
Overall, though, do you have any regrets about this? Or do you think that your life is, on balance, better or worse than it was a year ago?
I think my life is better than it was a year ago. And I was never really trying to conceal anything, as you noticed when you went back to check on me. The cultural Marxist gatekeepers of the community here in Seattle, we're very liberal here, and this newspaper is extremely liberal, and they needed to sell papers, and they've learned that they can sell more papers when they generate a scandal. After they got done with me, they went after a florist in town who had refused to sell flowers to a couple that wanted a gay couple for a gay wedding. I mean, that was the next big, you know, story that they wrote on for the next the rest of the month, you know. They needed a sacrificial goat, and they chose me, and that's that. So I knew who I was up against, and there really wasn't too much I could do about it. And it was kind of revealing to look at the, you know, I generated that article here, about 350 comments from people that are in the arts. And I couldn't believe how thick some of these folks are. I mean, they're supposed to be educated. They're supposed to be curious, and they're supposed to be talented. And God, are they stupid? I knew that Joe Sixpack is kind of thick, you know, with his preoccupation with Saturday afternoon professional sports and all that. But I had no idea the extent of the retardation of some of these people here that are in the arts. I mean, it was amazing, and what they think, and to see some of these guys come out swinging, it was just a really entertaining.
Yeah, there is nothing more vile and absurd than these vulgar, middle-brow pseudo-intellectuals.
Oh, God.
Yeah. They are really, really thick. Thick as two short planks. And so full of themselves. That's the other thing. Not only are they ignorant, but they sling that word around at us all the time. Oh, you're just ignorant.
Yeah.
Like, this is ignorance. It's just laughable. These people have never thought original thoughts in their lives. They've never read anything outside the New York Times bestseller list or what's been on their college syllabi. And they have the face to accuse us without missing a beat of ignorance. They've been programmed that way.
Oh, listen, ignorance and bigotry and
prejudice.
And prejudice, yeah. They call me a cranky white guy chasing immigrants off my lawn with a golf club. You know,
well, Charlie, this has been a great, great interview. Any last words before we wrap up?
I don't have any last words other than back to this idea of putting together some kind of a publication. We should ask the people that are interested. They can do it under a pseudonym if they'd like to, and maybe we could have them get in touch with either you or me.
Exactly.
Yeah, let's just put the word out that if you've got something you want to share and you think we might be able to use it in this context, like let's just say we're going to shoot for a one-issue anthology for beginners. Let's not say it's going to be anything other than that, really. To go ahead and let us know what it is you'd like to share, and then we'll look it over and we'll get back to you. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah.
Because I'd like to do this, too. I think it'd be fun to have an anthology of writing and writing on contemporary culture coming from our position instead of this Marxist position, you know.
All right. Well, I can hardly wait to have you back for another episode of Countercurrents Radio. So thank you, Charles Kraft.
Well, thank you for having me again, Greg. And thanks for being a good explicator the last time around when I was in such deep doo-doo. You were the only one that really... You and Carolyn Yeager, believe it or not, gave me a platform. But everything else was pretty negative. So anyway, I'd like to thank you for letting me be on the program.
All right. Well, this, I hope, is just one of many, many more appearances. So take care.
Okay. Thank you.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.